Earlier this hour, Colorado Governor Hickenlooper stressed that economic success in avoiding gentrification depend on the degree of inclusion of the full community. Point Breeze, Philadelphia has an inclusion problem, as we've seen, despite its success. But that's also a matter of opinion. Benjamin Grant is Urban Design Policy Director at Spur in San Francisco. He says confusion over who is benefiting in a changing neighborhood mirrors confusion over the G word itself.
Gentrification is kind of an imprecise term that takes in a lot of different phenomena, but broadly speaking, it's a process or a bunch of related processes by which a wealthier, typically whiter group of people start to move into an urban neighborhood that has historically been a working class neighborhood, neighborhood of color in many cases, and prices start to go up. And it's a process that has a lot of different actors and a lot of different forces shaping it, but we give the term gentrification to that process.
What is the component of this process that excludes other people and creates an economic problem for people who actually live in the neighborhood and aren't necessarily the beneficiaries of the development?
You know, there's a lot in that question and some important components to that. It's important to separate the idea of gentrification from the idea of displacement. I think that the inherent problem is displacement versus gentrification more broadly. And it's not intrinsically the case that the benefits of investment that come to those urban neighborhoods exclude the residents that live there. I think in some cases and with some kinds of investments, that's true. For example, a high-end restaurant or an exclusive condo building in one of these neighborhoods is certainly not something that's going to be available to the lower-income people that have historically lived there. On the other hand, you might see things like improvements to public safety or to schools or to parks that are a result of a new wave of investment that actually can benefit the community more broadly, those kinds of public goods that urban neighborhoods can provide.
What institutions, political institutions, urban state level institutions can develop a more urban planning approach to the forces of gentrification when it's clear that an area in a particular city or community is going to be developed to make sure that middle class housing and the widest variety of members of the community can benefit?
There are a lot of different layers or scales where policy can act. So probably the most immediate actor in that space is city planning and economic development departments, so city government, who control zoning. They control regulations about inclusionary housing, the ability to provide affordable housing financed by market rate housing, a way to leverage some of that investment to benefit a broader swath of people. And then you also have at a higher level of government, regional, state, and federal actors that channel a certain amount of tax credit financing for affordable housing, and also control the expenditure of funds on things like large infrastructure projects so that flow of dollars can benefit a broader swath of people.
How much of this is an image problem where you get terminology like, yuppie scum or evil hipsters or Eurotrash or buppies, any number of pejoratives that suggest that the people who are moving in don't have the most positive goals of the community in mind?
Sure. I think that sort of narrative and that set of terms is an unfortunate one, because the gentrification process that we see in many cities around the country, it's not something that one group of people is doing to another group of people. It's a process that is emerging from thousands of individual decisions. So it starts maybe with an artist who might have been priced out of a fancier neighborhood in that same city looking for an affordable space to make art and finding that opportunity in one of these communities. That might be followed by the familiar kind of train of changes, including, fancy coffee bars and restaurants and art galleries and then condo development. And then, as you get further down that process, it becomes easier and easier to point the finger at those people who are coming in. But in truth, every person involved in that process is part of that process. And this narrative of heroes and villains is one that doesn't really help us solve the problems that are involved in this. We need to understand that in many cities, we have a serious housing crisis, a shortage that results from us not providing adequate housing, particularly in the kinds of urban, walkable, amenity-rich neighborhoods that people increasingly want to live in. And I think it's important to note that this broader process is a side effect of a very positive change in American cities, where after 85 years of abandoning our cities, people want to live in cities again. And that's good news for the planet. That's good news for our democracy, I believe, in terms of public space and people living together instead of in isolated houses behind two-car garages and so forth. There's a lot of positive aspects to the American desire to live in cities again, but there are also very real consequences for people that stuck it out or were stuck during the period we abandon our cities and let them decline. So we need to keep in perspective that this is somewhat a creature of big picture urban and economic phenomena in this country, and some very good news, which is that we're interested in cities again.
What economic revival strategy do you support, and where do you see exciting things happening in communities around the country for listeners who are paying attention in places all around the country?
One of the most interesting things that I see is the revival of manufacturing in urban centers, typically smaller scale manufacturing, design, fabrication, prototyping, those kinds of things. And in some cases, that's almost bringing the sort of the big picture story of the American economy full circle, where we lost our manufacturing base, our heavy industry, and that was sort of the economic base of so many of those cities. So that's an interesting kind of full circle phenomenon that a lot of folks are watching.
Benjamin Grant is Urban Design Policy Director at SPUR, SPUR, a leading civic planning organization in California. It's great talking to you, Ben.
My pleasure. Thanks for having me.
So how has your neighborhood been changing? Austin, Texas. I grew up in Silicon Valley, first Cupertino, then Los Altos. The Bay Area has become so expensive and business-centric that as an artist and not a techie, there is no place for me there. I can't afford to live where I grew up.
This is Michelle from Hawaii. Building has exploded on Oahu. There's so little wild space left. Kaneohe, where I live, still has a country feel to it. The traffic is crazy all the time, all over the island, and housing prices are out of control.
My name is Patrick Miller. I'm calling from rural New Hampshire, and it seems like our neighborhood's getting older. I think that the high property taxes mean that it's hard for younger people to stay here.
Keep this conversation going. Call us at 877-8MYTAKE or comment at thetakeaway.org.